Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of January. Pioneers of Television is returning to PBS tonight in their second season, and they're looking at some classic television programs that were very important in many ways. Science fiction will be one of the episodes, westerns, crime dramas. Also, they'll be looking at local kids' television. I grew up during some of that era, and it's wonderful to see some of those old romper rooms and some of the shows that came out of Chicago, which was very large in children's television. We're happy to have Mike Trinkline with us. The first hour of today's program, Ron Reagan is our guest the second hour today. Mike is an Emmy-nominated writer and producer, and he is producer of Pioneers of Television. The co-creator is Steve Betcher, and they are both from Wisconsin. Mike produced the PBS documentaries The Oregon Trail and The Gold Rush. He's written for the Wall Street Journal and the Boston Globe. His recent book on American states was a bestseller. For 20 years, he was a professor at Idaho State University. He was raised in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, and graduated from the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, moved back to Wisconsin in 2004, and his focus has been seasons one and two of PBS's Pioneers of Television. A great deal of care went into putting together all of these shows, and you'll enjoy seeing them starting this evening. Hello, Mike. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I forgot about all of those programs, and you did it with such care to find the people who were in those shows originally, who had great reflections on what it is they had done. You had to sift through, I'm sure, tons of television to decide what you were going to highlight.
Well, that's true. Actually, the first step was to find the people who could talk about it. I mean, many of those celebrities are still alive. And I have to give great credit to my co-producer, Steve Betcher. He's the guy who has the dogged determination to land these interviews. And a lot of times it was a real challenge. And a lot of these people would sit and talk with us for hours about their career, which many had never really done before. So we got lots of great tidbits about their lives that may not be widely known.
Do you think they were forgotten? Did they feel forgotten?
Well, some have been forgotten. That's true. I mean, even a guy like Mike Connors from TV's Mannix, you know, which is actually kind of an interesting show in a lot of ways. You know, no one's really talked to him for years. He hasn't been interviewed. And it's, of course, there are much bigger celebrities that we talk to, like James Garner and Bill Cosby. And a lot of them just had things to say about their careers that maybe they hadn't had the opportunity to talk about. Because when an Inside Edition or Entertainment Tonight interviews them, if it does, because they're skewed so young, if they do, it's one question. And they really don't get a chance to kind of talk about the bigger picture. And that's what hopefully this series does.
Right. Was there a favorite genre for you? You have so many different programs in different genres. Was it kids television or crime drama or...
Well, I grew up watching Star Trek you know, here in Milwaukee on Saturday afternoons when it was in reruns, and sort of just loved that show. So the science fiction one was really kind of cool, and it was just a great experience to sit down with some of your idols like William Shatner or Leonard Nimoy, go to Leonard Nimoy's house, you know, and sort of see what it's like and talk to him, or even the stars of a show like Lost in Space to kind of get their perspective on things. It was a lot of fun.
Uh-huh. And it was fun to see some of the people who starred in the kids' programs who have gone on to pretty stellar careers in other areas, Willard Scott and some others who, and all of the Romper Room. I remember a little bit of Romper Room, how those shows, well, let's talk about them for a moment. They were very local, many of them, but they had a pattern to them, just different people in different cities.
Well, yeah, I think we sometimes forget how in the early days of television, the assumption was that TV would all be local. And in fact, if you go over to Channel 4 and you walk in the front door, they have this huge studio. Well, they did at one time. They eventually remodeled it. But I mean, they figured, like every station did, they'd be doing lots and lots of local shows with local audiences. And the shows that caught on the most at the, in the 50s and 60s were the kids shows. And you're right, every town had a... You know, it was a pirate, or it was a spaceman, or it was a clown. And, you know, in Milwaukee, we had Albert the Alley Cat. You know, we had all kinds of different, you know, kids-oriented shows in every city. And some of them, as you mentioned, were sort of franchised ideas. You know, Bozo was a franchise. There was a different Bozo in Chicago, a different one in Milwaukee, a different Bozo in Green Bay. And Romper Room, similarly, was a franchised idea. There's a different woman in every single city. And these ideas were formulas that worked, just like McDonald's was a formula that worked, and every city had their own little iteration of it.
And kids would actually, there were some interviews with kids who went to those shows who were part of the studio audience, because they were always live. So there are a couple funny bits about what some of the kids did, but also it was then they go home and watch television too, and all on a scale that was so much slower than what we're used to now. I was really struck by that.
It is really true. I mean, I think just even in the last 10 or 15 years, the pace of television has ramped up so much that even in us picking clips for this series, we had to keep a modern audience in mind because a lot of these shows, you know, they take time to play out a story and they were entertaining in their day, but modern audiences might misinterpret this as being boring or slow. It's just you've got to give it time and the patience to let it play out. So, yeah, there was a whole different, I mean, Ray Rayner in Chicago would actually, his bit, he was a kids host in Chicago, very popular one, played with Bozo a lot, but he would literally take kits of toys and put them together on the air. I mean, can you imagine, you know, 30 minutes of, you know, part A and part B, you know, but kids loved it, you know.
The other interesting thing was, and we've killed Bill Cosby into this too because he was so important in so many ways, but the commercialization, it was amazing to see these people try to sell their products, the milk or the cookies or the cereal or whatever's in your, here in the supermarket, you can get it. And then the reaction to say, wait a second, maybe we shouldn't do this on children's television.
Well, it's true. All those local kids shows of the 50s and 60s, they made their money by selling products. So they would, you know, if you want to, you could buy the Romper Room horse, you know, at your local store, and they would tell you where to buy it and how much it cost or whatever the various item was that tied in with the show. I mean, they really, it was the hard sell. It really was. And in some ways, it just kind of, it's part of a consumer culture. And one woman, really, Peggy Charon in Boston woke up one day and said, this is just outrageous. And she almost single-handedly changed the face of children's television by starting a group in her home of concerned mothers. And they grew and they got bigger. They went before Congress. They got their congressman and senator involved. And within a few years, the law was changed so that local kids hosts could not overtly sell products. And that law is still on the books today. Now, in one hand, that's good because it meant that we weren't, you know, hawking to kids. On the other hand, it's bad because all these shows basically couldn't support themselves, and all the local pirates and clowns and spacemen went off the air mostly.
Bill Cosby figures prominently in several of the series. He was really a historical figure in Pioneers of Television, wasn't he, in terms of being the first African American in a crime drama show, in also his Fat Albert on television as well. He was so prominent.
Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting guy in many ways, and we did interview him for the series, and really, he's a tough interview to get. And again, you know, Steve Betcher, my co-producer, managed to coerce him into going on camera because he does not do these kind of interviews.
Really?
He,
why do you think?
I think he's afraid of being misquoted. He's had some experiences where, you know, people have edited him in a way that wasn't, you know, really the gist of what he said, and he was kind of upset about that. So Steve talked him into it, and we did the interview. And yeah, you're right. In terms of I Spy was the crime drama that he did, and it was the first show to have an African-American lead on a television drama. And, you know, nowadays that seems unremarkable, but then it was a really big deal. And, in fact, a lot of stations in the South threatened not to run the show because, you know, they just didn't think that was something they wanted to air. And it was
really
a real challenge. This is in the middle of the Civil Rights era. And, you know, he talks to that in the series as to, you know, how he felt, whether he felt he was a role model or not. You know, I asked him about that. I said, you know, you were the, when I grew up in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, you were the only sort of black man I, you know, knew because I could see you on TV. There weren't any, you know, African Americans in Cedarburg at the time. And, you know, his response to, you know, are you a groundbreaker was, well, it wasn't enough. He felt like his role as a role model didn't change things as much as he would have liked them to change. So he does. And in the kids episode, he comes up again. You're right. He actually got his PhD in childhood education. I read his dissertation.
Did really, you really?
Yeah, you can get it for $10, and I read all 128 pages. And he just felt like from the beginning that television should be a tool for the positive, to educate. And so whether it was Fat Albert or even with the Cosby Show, he felt like he was trying to communicate lessons to people, that television could be a source of positive role modeling and positive morality. And he was very much in favor of that, to the point where he went and got a degree so he could do it better.
And, of course, Fred Rogers thought of television in a similar fashion.
Yeah.
I loved Fred Rogers. I loved him.
Well, and in the series, we talk about Fred, but not about you know, his Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, we go into the show before that, Children's mm-hmm. Corner, in his local show, and sort of see how he sort of developed into what he was. And what a great show in the sense that it was so... It had respect for kids in a time when not a lot of TV shows did, and it had a pacing that I guess showed respect for kids. It didn't insist on being fast and furious. He was a guy who loved kids, and that came through every single day.
You mentioned Star Trek, and we have a clip of Star Trek, which I'm going to ask you to set up for us. But was that an unusual thing to put on television? I know people who love that show and still watch it in reruns, and they're in their 50s. You know, if you can watch it on reruns, or they've got it on tape somewhere, they just love Star Trek. What captivated you about that program?
Well, I think what was most interesting about Star Trek was that it was designed as a tool to get across, well, an agenda. I mean, many would say a positive agenda, but Gene Roddenberry wanted to persuade the nation. He had issues that he wanted to address, whether it was the horrors of war or racial integration or even drug abuse. I mean, all kinds of things were addressed in that show in sort of a subtle way. He tried to address those issues on an earlier series called The Lieutenant, which we show some clips from, but he just got a lot of flack from the network and from people not liking him being too controversial. So he said, well, I'll place all this stuff in the future. You won't really know you're getting a lesson, maybe, if they're, you know, Klingons or something instead of, you know, the people next door. And so the fact that he had an agenda was what was really interesting, because there was science fiction before that show. I mean, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and Lost in Space were also kind of similar kinds of shows, but they didn't have that sort of perspective of trying to influence the culture that Gene Roddenberry had.
Mm-hmm. And this is a clip of a young woman, African-American woman, again, one of the pioneers in television.
Nichelle Nichols, yeah. She was the first African... She was in Star Trek. She played Uhura. All the Star Trek fans will know that. And she was really the first African-American on television who was not a servant or, you know, some sort of a subservient role. She was the fourth in command, and that was a very controversial idea at that time, to have an African-American woman who was in charge of things. And she wanted to quit the show, and because she wasn't getting enough to do, because what would happen is that they'd write scripts for her, and William Shatner, because he was a very outgoing personality, he would have the scripts rewritten so he would have more of the lines. So she was so frustrated. She just didn't have enough to do on the show. She wanted to quit, and I think that's where your clip picks up.
Executives at NBC wanted the same for their science fiction show, Star Trek. But creator Gene Roddenberry wasn't interested in adding more monsters. He saw Star Trek as a vehicle to influence social change. And in 1960s America, few topics seemed more important than racial equality and women's rights. Issues that TV ignored. But Gene Roddenberry wasn't afraid. For two decades, African-American women were allowed only one role on television.
It ought to. The
servant.
Lieutenant Uhura, take over navigation.
The breakthrough came when Nichelle Nichols was cast as Lieutenant Uhura, fourth in command on the Starship Enterprise. But Uhura was soon written out of storylines as other characters became more dominant. Frustrated, Nichols wrote a letter of resignation. Within hours, a certain dedicated fan requested a special meeting.
And I stood up to turn around and meet the Trekkie. And there is this man, bigger than life human being, Dr. Martin Luther King. He says, I'm the Trekkie. He says, I'm the biggest Trekkie on the planet, and I am Lieutenant Uhura's most ardent fan. He went on to say how important Star Trek was, that images on television permeate the culture, either for the good or for the bad, and this is for the highest good. He said, you cannot abdicate your position. You are changing the minds of people across the world, because for the first time through you, we see ourselves. What can be, what we are fighting for, what we are marching for.
That is an incredible story. I had no idea that he had done that.
Yeah, it was. It's really amazing to see. You know, even then, this perception of just how powerful TV can be. And back then, there were only three channels anybody could watch. So any given show had a huge audience. And, you know, we saw these shows and it influenced us even in ways we may not realize. And, you know, just to see role models that you can aspire to. We talked to the cast of Lost in Space, and they all went down to NASA a few years ago. You know, they're all grown up now, of course. And they said that all these NASA aerospace engineers and astronauts came up to them and said, you know, we watched your show and we thought, this could be cool. And they went into this field as a result. So, I mean, we forget how powerful TV can be.
Yeah, I loved your comment that about TV being used for the highest good. We don't think of TV that way usually, but it has been.
Yeah, I mean, it has been. It has the potential to be. And you're right. There's a lot of junk on TV, no doubt about it. There are a lot of junk in a bookstore. I mean, there's you've got to sort out and find the good stuff. And hopefully that's what we did in the series.
Yeah, you sure did. We welcome phone calls. Let me give you our phone number. I'm not sure I have done that yet. Our number is 800-486-8655. Mike Trinkline is our guest, and he is the producer of Pioneers of Television Season 2. It starts tonight on PBS, and we're proud to say that he is from Wisconsin, along with Steve Betcher, co-creator and producer. They have done a number of shows, The Oregon Trail, The Gold Rush, and Mike has taught at Idaho State University for a number of years, graduated from UW Oshkosh, and did a book on the American States. We had him on about that, which was a bestseller. We had great fun with that show. Oh my gosh, our phones are crazy. We have yet to talk about the Westerns. Remember Gunsmoke? We will talk about those, more about science fiction and children's programs. And what's the other area that I've...
Crime drama.
Crime drama.
Yes.
Angie Dickinson.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Saw some interviews with her. We welcome your calls and we'll take them momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of the program, Ron Regan, will be with us. He and his mother were having a conversation about his father, who would have turned 100 on February 6th of this year. And it got Ron thinking about his father's early life. He went back to Dixon, Illinois, and looked at the formative years. He also traced the family history from Ireland and went to Ireland. It's really a lovely book. The two of them had very different political ideas, but this is his father and a man he respected deeply. So Ron Regan, President Reagan's son, will join us to talk about his book, My Father at 100, our number two. Let's welcome phone calls for Mike Trinkline, producer of Pioneers of Television, airs tonight. Series number two starts tonight on PBS. And we start our phone calls with Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there, Kathleen. Okay, Star Trek. Very exciting to talk about Star Trek. I just read this book by Leonard Nimoy, and he said that in the original script, the first officer was a woman, played by Majel Barrett, and that the network said, we can't possibly, and they made a pilot with that, didn't they? And then the network was like, no, this is too much. We can't have a woman as second in command, and we can't have a guy with green skin and pointy ears. You have to get rid of both of them. And Gene said, well, okay, I have to have Spock, but we'll lose the woman, and then he married her instead.
Well, all that is exactly correct. Yes, that's exactly how the story goes. And we talk about some of those things in the show. One thing we also is fascinating, I didn't know until I did the research for the show, that Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura, actually originally read for the role of Spock. And
really?
Yeah. And we also talk about how in the show that Martin Landau was the original choice for Spock. And he was offered the role and turned it down. And he kind of talks about that in the episode and in ways that aren't, well, I guess you can interpret it for yourself. I thought it wasn't terribly flattering to Leonard Nimoy, but maybe there's another room for interpretation there.
Huh. Why did Star Trek catch your fancy so, Sarah?
Man, I have been wondering about that myself lately. And I don't know. You know, I think a lot of it is just because I like Spock so much. But I really got into it with The Next Generation, and then I went back and watched the original. So I don't know. It's really excellent escapism. That's maybe what it is. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. You know what I think it is? I think there's a certain element of Star Trek was the first science fiction show that took a positive view of the future. You know, everything before that was aliens and monsters and nuclear war and bad stuff's going to happen with all this technology. And Star Trek took a positive view in the same way that, you know, Steve Jobs takes a positive view with computers, and we all were afraid of computers, and now we realize they're great tools. And I think Star Trek realized that all the stuff that was happening could have a positive outcome.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sarah. You'll be interested in seeing the show tonight.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for the call. Janet from Sauk City. Hi.
Hi there. I've been watching TV for about 55 years, so I've seen a really lot of TV, and I too like Star Trek. But I would have to say that I think that the show for me that did more to bring out things and did more to teach people things was All in the Family, because nothing was taboo on there. They talked about the change of life. There was one episode where Edith supposedly got sexually attacked. And I just thought it was, you know, it brought out things that needed to be brought out, and they weren't afraid to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, All in the Family certainly was a complete sea change in television. You have to realize that before that show came on, you know, you had shows like Gomer Pyle and Andy Griffith and all these sort of rural shows. And then all of a sudden, you know, CBS decided to go with all these much different shows like All in the Family that really... You know, it was so controversial that here in Milwaukee, they actually ran it on in the afternoons, not in prime time.
No
they were
kidding.
Afraid, yeah.
Ooh.
Until it caught on and they had no choice, but yeah.
How long was that show on? Do you know, Mike?
It premiered in 1970, and it went for at least a decade, yeah.
Huh. Some of these shows, give us an idea of the long-running nature. Some of these shows were on the air for years and decades.
Well, yeah, a good example would be like Bonanza that ran for 14 years, or the granddaddy of them all was Gunsmoke, which ran for 20. And, you know, it's funny, Kelsey Grammer is our narrator, and he actually
Great
tied...
Great job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He tied the record with the Gunsmoke folks for longest-running TV character. His character, Frasier Crane, ran for 20 years. And, in fact, one thing he told us, you know, sort of as an aside, he said, you know, I thought about going an extra year just to beat him. But I have to tell you, it's a really heady thing when you sit in your little office in Cedarburg for months and months writing these scripts, and then to hear Kelsey Grammer read what you wrote, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, he did a lovely job.
Yeah.
He's a fine narrator. And Gunsmoke, let's talk about that. There is a name. That show must have been on. I didn't watch it much, but it must have been on in my house because people in the family certainly watched it. What was the appeal of those Westerns in that time? There were several of them.
Yeah, I think part of it is the fact that before television started, there was a huge Western movie industry.
Oh.
And all the B-movies, you know, the lower budget movies were Westerns. So the sets were built, the storylines were already written, the characters were sort of developed, the horse stunt riders were ready to go. And so, you know, when television came along, you needed to make a lot of TV. They naturally tried Westerns, and they were a hit. So, at one point, there were a total of over 100 different television Westerns on.
No.
Yeah. Not all at the same time, but over the 10 or 12 years, there were 100 different Westerns, yeah.
But some of them had sort of a theme of taking care of the family. The story is centered on the sons, you know, the father trying to keep things together. It wasn't always a... bang, bang, shoot everybody kind of thing. It was relationships.
Yeah, you make a really strong point in that the Westerns, each of them was unique in its own way. And Bonanza, for example, was all about the father-son relationship. It was really more of a relationship show than it was a Western show. And in fact, David Dortort, who created the Bonanza, said he would never have a woman in a lead role, and there never was. If a woman showed up in an episode, you knew she was going to be killed or
oh my
sent
goodness.
Out of town. Yeah. But then there were other shows like The Rifleman that was also kind of a father-son relationship, but in sort of a different way. That was actually created by Sam Peckinpah and had a very different kind of feel to it. And then there were, you know, Gunsmoke was really kind of a family drama in a way, too. And then you have shows like Lone Ranger that were sort of more kid-oriented. And of course, we also talked to Robert Conrad, who did Wild Wild West, and that was a very different kind of a Western and a really interesting guy to talk to.
Hmm. Thanks very much, Janet, for your call. Jess from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
Hi, Jess.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yes, hello?
Go
okay.
Right ahead.
When I was in 2007, I was living in Rochester, New York, and went back to college for the first time in a long time. And I took an introductory English course where I used Star Trek as a metaphor for our political system and how the United States has worked in the last three or four decades, in the sense that it was Kirk, the strong male figure, and the women were nurses and yeomans and things like this. And then you get to the Next Generation, and then now they're the doctors and so on. And then finally you have Deep Space Nine, where a black guy is in charge. And then you had Voyager, where finally now you have Janeway. She's the captain of the ship. So I, in my report, in my paper that I wrote in this class, I wrote, we will have a black president before we will have a woman president. And this was in 2007. And I used Star Trek as the metaphor for this. I think going on to the other point that you guys made, why is it so popular, the show, is because it did away with a lot of the prejudices, even though it has a future setting. It was a positive future. Also, it did away with the greed factor of how things are being run here. And it was people something, you know, that they wanted to look forward to, I think. Well, you brought up All in the Family before. Just one quick point there, if I may. All in the Family is a great show. The sad thing about it is if you watch it today and you trade out Vietnam for Iraq and Nixon for Bush, really nothing has changed socially. And that's the sad telling for where, you know, what about the show. The show is a great show. It's really a sad telling on society.
What do you watch now, Jess?
Pardon?
What do you watch now on television?
Now we don't have a television.
No.
Well, when they went analog, from analog to digital and all that, I never went with it. I'll watch a lot of Highlander on DVD type of thing. I'll watch the reruns of All in the Family on DVD or MASH. I introduce my kids to MASH. I happen to be a big John Wayne fan, Clint Eastwood, so I'll introduce these strong characters to my children. But a lot of the shows today just don't measure up.
Uh-huh. Mike?
Well, you know, there are... Television today, in terms of its production, is really better than it's ever been. I mean, I watched a lot of old TV, and so there's a lot of good shows out there, but there are a lot of bad shows out there, too. And it's, I think, important for people to kind of be very selective, especially with their kids, and watch what their kids are watching and make good decisions. You know, his point about Star Trek is interesting in that it kind of reiterates the notion that Gene Roddenberry, the creator, really was trying to make a point, and that is true throughout all the Star Trek series, that there really was I don't want to say an agenda, but there was a goal. It wasn't just entertainment. There was a larger picture that they were trying to convey to people.
Thanks, Jess, very much for the call. Diane in Wauwatosa, hi.
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 Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I heard your guest talk about Star Trek as the first time that there was, you know, a strong female African-American role on television, and my comment is he didn't go back far enough. When I was very little, one of my favorite shows was Amos and Andy, and Sapphire, she was my hero. All the other women on television at the time, they were wimps. You know, they had to play games or distract people with sexuality or deceive people to get what they wanted. But not Sapphire. Nobody messed with her. She got what she wanted usually, and if she didn't, she was straightforward about it. She did, you know, she just said what she felt, and nobody pushed her around. And growing up as a really little girl, that was really, really important to me, because when I looked around, I saw women always in a submissive role. And what's odd is that every time I've watched PBS about old television shows, Amos and Andy is never mentioned. It's as if it never existed.
Mike.
Well, part of the reason that, you know, you don't see Amos and Andy in syndication is that it, you know, because it was, you know, white people portraying African-American people, it isn't terribly well received these days. It's just not something that people really want to watch. And when I was talking about Lieutenant Uhura and Nichelle Nichols, I mean, I was talking about dramas. It's true in comedies there are, you know, it's a little different story and not as realistic a portrayal, but certainly a little bit different story there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Diane, very much for your call. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join it. Our conversation, our number is 800-486-8655. You had an interesting interview with Angie Dickinson, which I was watching last night, who was asked to be supportive of a feminist cause, and yet she liked being sexy and didn't mind that at all. She also felt that she was a pretty strong woman in the role that she was in. It was really an interesting interview.
What did you think, Kathleen, as a woman who's accomplished things in life, about a woman who didn't want to support the feminist movement? Did you think she was out of line, or do you think she was made sense, or what did you think?
Well, she did. You know, it was interesting because she didn't really want to go into the show until somebody said, wouldn't you like to be a household name? Because she seemed to want to be taking care of her children and at home. I don't know. I'm considering the times. It was earlier than a very strong feminist movement, and I'm sure that it was greatly appealing to make the kind of money and get the attention that she did. I'm slightly uncomfortable with some of the shimmying with not very many clothes on, you know, because I grew up in the era a little bit after that, and it's slightly uncomfortable. But I found her a compelling presence on television. I think my dad really liked her. That's what I remember.
Well, she was a gorgeous woman. I mean,
yes,
there's no doubt
beautiful.
About that. And she, you know, she played a policewoman in 1974, and you think, well, that's kind of late to be a pioneer. But in reality, even in the Milwaukee Police Department did not have a female cop until 1975.
Wow.
So, I mean, it really was a groundbreaking show in that way. It made us see that women could do something they couldn't, that otherwise we thought they couldn't do, or some people thought they couldn't do. It is interesting, though. I mean, she did always play an undercover role where she was taking off her clothes for one reason or another. And, you know, she was this, you know, well, whatever. But what's funny is we actually had to cut some of those clips because they were just, I mean, they were just sort of not inappropriate, but they, you know, she would dance for long stretches in silly outfits that we kind of felt might embarrass her, and so we had to kind of be judicious with that. But she really was a groundbreaker, and she really, your point is really interesting. She was the only woman on TV, the first woman who was a lead in a drama. She was this policewoman, and yet she didn't really feel like she wanted to take up the mantle of the feminist movement. She just wanted to do her job and go home to her family.
Right. Was she fun to talk to? She seemed like a really nice person.
Yeah, she was sweet. I mean, she really, it's kind of funny. You don't get to that position in life unless you know how to make things happen. We came into the room, and she immediately told Steve Betcher, my co-producer, you know, now put the light over here. Now I think you should put the mic over here. I mean, very nice way, very
right.
polite. And she was right, you know, about what she wanted. But, I mean, she was not shy about telling us what she wanted.
Yeah, what made her look the best.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go next to Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. I grew up in the Chicago area, and we had our first TV in 1949. To me, the pioneers, like for children's programming, was Kukla, Fran, and Ollie.
Yes.
With Bert Ilstrom and Fran Allison.
Mm-hmm.
I used to love that show. And then, of course, for variety shows was Ed Sullivan on Sunday night. That was the first big one that provided a lot of entertainment with big stars on there. And yes, Chicago was the heyday of television at that time. The producers, William Bell and Lee Bell, who did The Young and the Restless out of Chicago, I mean, they certainly have capitalized on their humble beginnings in the Chicago market.
You had a TV in 1949?
Yes, we did.
You were the first in the neighborhood, weren't you?
Well, maybe first or second. And I know my mother wasn't too pleased when my father brought it home because she said, oh, the children aren't going to study anymore. But you know, in those days, many times all that was on TV were the test patterns. And we would turn it on just to watch the test patterns.
Oh, my. That's funny, Patricia. Mike.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, Chicago really was a center for television in that period. And there, again, there was this notion that each town would have its own sort of, you know, we'd do soap operas in Milwaukee and we'd do kids shows in Madison. And, you know, it didn't quite work out that way, but it was an interesting time. And, of course, we did talk a lot about the kids shows out of Chicago, the Bozos and those kind of shows, Garfield Goose. And yeah, they're.
Oh, Garfield Goose,
yeah,
yes.
Great shows.
Yeah. I grew up in Chicago, too, Patricia. I remember those programs very well. Let's go. Thanks for your call. Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I grew up in Chicago, too.
Ah.
And I remember on Sunday mornings, because the only thing on for kids was Tiny Tove, the Magic Door. It was Hebrew for children who weren't didn't have Sabbath on Saturday.
Oh.
But what do I call her? I'm 55, and I was raised with the myth of Donna Reed, and quite quite verklempt when I found out, you know, in the real world, that it wasn't pumps, pearls, and perfection. So occasionally I trot out my I hate Donna Reed costume. It's just pearls. And but it did television, and being 55, we were coming up when we were told we could do anything and everything, and so we as women got some really mixed messages from the box.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. We were just talking about Angie Dickinson. There were mixed messages.
That's true, and I was just thinking about the notion of, you know, was Donna Reed really like what she was like? I don't know, but I do know that most of the people that we interviewed were really not terribly far from their TV persona, and that is, if you're going to be on TV for hours and hours and hours, that you generally, your real-life personality tends to dominate, and a guy like James Garner, he's like that, and Linda Evans, she's like that. I mean, they're really sort of very nice, personable people, generally speaking, and it's maybe different from a movie star who can sort of act in a role for, you know, a few weeks, and we assume that, but on television, then you're on over and over and over again, your sort of base personality comes through, and audiences are really smart. Audiences can pick up on somebody who's kind of faking or acting, and who's someone who's just genuinely likable.
Mm-hmm. It must be hard, and tell me about, several of the people talked about the pace of shows. If you're doing so many shows a year, so many lines to learn, that it can run its course after a while. There isn't enough to say, but it's really demanding to be on television that much, I would think.
It is, and this is something that we often don't realize, but it is brutal. I mean, basically, if you're doing an hour-long drama, especially, you know, nowadays we have ensemble shows, but back in those days, you know, James Garner doing Rockford Files or something, they would be there from 6 in the morning until 8 or 9 at night.
Oh, my gosh.
And not 5 days a week. They would do this 6 days a week. They would get one day off, and this would go on, and they would do, you know, 30 episodes. So for almost the entire year, and a lot of them, you know, you read in the papers about all their family issues and, you know, relationship problems. Well, part of it is the fact they just never got to see their families because they were working so much. And in fact, that was the funny thing. That was the deal that Angie Dickinson cut when she did Policewoman. She said, I'll do the show, but I've got to be home by 6 or I quit. And they worked it out for her. But that was a rare deal.
Did they make good money?
You know, no. I mean, it's kind of funny. Not really. I mean, the money wasn't even good by standards of the day. I mean, television was a lot of times considered a second-class medium compared to films. And so they, you know, some of the stars got pretty good money, but a lot of them, you know, did not. And so therefore, they're still working today.
Thanks, Lynn, very much for your call. Dan in Stevens Point, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Dan.
I just wanted to address something that hasn't really been talked about here, and that's the civic responsibilities that these shows portrayed. Like Bonanza was almost like the family that they didn't just take care of themselves, they took care of their town and the people around them. You know, Star Trek was about, you know, this basically almost like a police force that was out in space. You know, they weren't just patrolling, going through space. They were also taking care and making sure that, you know, they did their civic duty kind of almost. And I think that was an appealing thing to a generation that, you know, everybody wanted to be a Boy Scout and a Girl Scout. And, you know, we were all civic-minded.
Well, that's a great point.
Yeah, I think your caller makes a tremendous point. And in fact, I'll put on my professor hat for a minute and talk about, there's tons of research that backs up this notion that, you know, television really does communicate values in very subtle ways, and we sort of often don't realize. And it's really important for, you know, especially for parents when they're viewing shows, to not just look at, you know, the word they don't like, maybe a character saying, but the underlying values of that character and underlying values of that show. Are they portraying positive messages, or, you know, is the dad in the sitcom a buffoon and they all make fun of him? I mean, it's interesting how influential this is. I mean, my favorite research, if I can digress for a moment, is on Brady Bunch. I grew up on the Brady Bunch, and what's funny about that is that they've done studies that show that in my generation, when we went on our first date, we didn't know, you know, how do you do this? What do you do? Where do you go? We all sort of did what we saw the Brady Bunch kids doing, you know? Do you go to the front door? Do you wear your shiny shoes? Do you say hi to the dad? I mean, do you go to the malt shop? I mean, we saw what was on television. That's what we did. And so it's a really powerful medium in a lot of ways, and we can't forget that, yeah.
And was it a good date, first date? Was it?
No one would say yes. I don't think I had a single date in high school, so I watched too much TV.
And you could have had a great malt. Going for a malt is a good idea on a first date, no matter how old you are.
True.
We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. PBS is the second season of this. All new shows, obviously, new genres. Pioneers of television, and it is going to be on tonight. What time tonight?
7 o'clock.
Okay, 7 o'clock tonight. And they're looking at science fiction, at westerns, at crime dramas, and at local kids' TV, and they'll be in that order. So tonight it's science fiction. Some great interviews with stars of the show and clips from the show, and Kelsey Grammer is narrating all of it. More phone calls momentarily. We also have this email. I'm sorry, I have to go to some emails. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Tuesday, Ron Reagan, will be joining us. He has written a very captivating and lovely book about his father, My Father at 100. So we'll be speaking with Ron Reagan, our number two. This hour, Pioneers of Television, second season starts tonight on PBS at 7 o'clock. Mike Trinkline is our guest. He is producer of Pioneers of Television, and he also has done a number of other PBS documentaries. Co-creator of this is Steve Betcher. And both of you are from, we should play up the Wisconsin ties here for a moment. You both went to the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. You're from this area. You've worked in, Steve, I know, has worked in television in this area, and you as well. And there are some local angles to all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's Hollywood story, but it was actually made right here in Wisconsin. So there are a number of times in the series where we're recreating some episode of some celebrity's life. And almost without exception, we did that here. There's a great old, there's no really good old Hollywood studios in Hollywood anymore. They're all remodeled. But there is one in Milwaukee over on 27th Street, and we shot there a lot because it looks just like 1955. Or when we wanted to recreate, you know, Jim Rockford's, trailer on the beach, we shot it down at McKinley Beach. Perfect.
Did you really?
Stands in for the ocean perfectly, you know. Huh. And there are lots of really interesting locations and neighborhoods in Wisconsin. And so we try to shoot as much here. And we also use lots of local actors. I mean, from Jonathan West, kind of a great local guy, and lots of other hundreds, really, of local actors that were used to play the roles of different celebrities earlier in their lives. So, it was a made in Wisconsin show. The tax credit helped us to do that. You know, is an incentive to do it here, and it was just a lot of fun to use local people and to make the show right here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and did it take a long time? It's just so detailed, Mike. Did it take years?
Oh my gosh, yes, it's been sort of a complete. It's dominated my life and Steve's life as well for the last couple of years because, you know, you have to first land the interview, and Steve's really good at that, but it takes a lot of time to get these people to the point where they'll talk with you. And then you have to find the archival clips. And when we found a film of Rod Serling that no one's seen before that, you know, was in a basement in Kansas for the last 25 years and photos that no one's seen before. And you got to dig through the Library of Congress. You know that ending scene from Indiana Jones? It's kind of like that, where there's millions of boxes and you got to find that one photo that's no one's seen before in the back room. And so there's just a tremendous amount of archival work. And then when you do find the perfect clip to go with a perfect shot, you've got to get the rights to that. And that's very complex. So it's a very painstaking process that you work through second by second, frame by frame for years till we get to hopefully not just a history. It's not really a history. It's just hopefully an entertaining kind of fun show that revisits some of these celebrities and talks about
right.
their lives. Yeah.
And they have important things to say,
very
too,
so, yeah.
which is good. Let's go to Scott from Marinette. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I need to preface my question first with I don't watch much network television or television per se, except for maybe some of the History Channel things. I'm more learning or educational, so I don't know that much what's on nowadays, but it seems to me, skipping through the channels once in a while, it seems to be a lot of crime dramas, violence, and or people just hooking up in general is what seems to be scattering the airwaves now. But my question is, it seemed like in the 70s and maybe 80s, there more was kind of a, some shows started having a political, social statement to make. Obviously, All in the Family and MASH, but then there was Maude and One Day at a Time. Seemed to take social, political issues of the same type. Does that occur nowadays or not? It just doesn't, it doesn't seem like it, there's much of a substance to anything.
Well, I can't speak to modern shows as much, but I can say that from the beginning, a lot of television producers had something to say, and they found a way to work that into their script. Even shows like Gunsmoke and Bonanza, you would find an attitude of a positive approach towards people of different ethnicities that was built into those shows when it was not necessarily built into American culture. I mean, it was, there was a, an overt attempt to use those shows for what the producers considered a positive values from the very beginning. Now, there were other producers who were just trying to make a buck and have a fun show. I mean, the Irwin Allen, we talk about, a great guy who made like Lost in Space and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and he wanted action and excitement. That's what he wanted. But there were a lot of people from the very beginning who have tried to use this medium to move the culture, and usually in positive ways.
Mm-hmm. Crime drama. Somebody said in that series that you have that American audiences couldn't get enough of that, but it was done, some of the shows like Dragnet, in very different ways, wasn't it? You never saw the actual murder on television. You saw the aftermath, how people's lives were affected by it.
Well, that's one of the most remarkable changes, I think, going back to your caller, over time, and that is that modern television shows are much, they're not more violent, but they're much more gory.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you watch a CSI and you'll see somebody, you know, sliced open and their brains and all
not
that.
Not me. I won't watch it.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, a show like The Untouchables was really considered extremely violent. But if you look at The Untouchables, as I've had to do many episodes, you'll see they shot a lot of guns, but there wasn't blood or there wasn't gore. But shows like Dragnet, which you mentioned, you're right, that the focus was more on the effect of the crime, not so much on the crime itself. Or even a show like Columbo. There was always a crime, there was a murder, but you really weren't talking so much about the actual corpse. You were more, it was more sort of a puzzle to figure out who did it or how they did it. So, yeah, I think television today is much, much different than it was in that sense, yeah.
Why do people watch that? I'm just particularly creeped out by all of that horrendous stuff. I just can't watch it. It just kind of makes me sick. But obviously, a lot of people watch that and want to watch it, and I've never figured out why. So, well, tell me why.
Yeah, well, I wish I had all the answers. I think partly it's just this sort of ramping up over the years. I mean, television gets more explicit in different ways, you know, sexually, as your caller said, and also in terms of the gore. And it's just, you want to one up the previous show, so you just do something a little bit more. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's go next to Betty in Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love this program, and I love your program anyway, Catherine.
Thanks, Betty.
When I was growing up, and this is about 1951, and now the first neighbors had a television, and it was a farming community, and it was about, they lived about probably 2.5-3 miles from us. But in the evening, after all the cows were milked, and chores were done and supper was eaten, we'd pile in the car and we'd go over to the north residence. They were farmers. And all these other neighbors from around how many miles radius would all be over there watching. This house, this room was full of all these people watching Boston Blackie and I can't remember some of the other ones, but... can you imagine this day and age, everybody coming over to your place? And we didn't have telephones, so they didn't know we were coming.
But, were they happy to see you?
Well, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But it was a part of sharing, I guess.
Yeah, then maybe we should reinstitute that idea of coming over to somebody's house and sitting and watching television for a while. That'd be kind of nice. Huh?
Well, it is kind of neat that, you know, they had that social experience. I know when I went to school at UW Oshkosh, you know, we didn't have TVs in our rooms. This is, you know, the late 70s, most of us. So we would all go down to the common area and watch shows. And it is a different experience. And in many ways, it's better to watch with someone else and have
right.
some interaction. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. Let's quickly take one more phone call. Irene and Phillips. We just have a minute left, Irene.
Yeah, hi. I grew up in Chicago, too, and I guess I beat American Idol because too bad that show wasn't around then. I was on the American, no, Morris Bisak's Amateur Hour on TV in 1950 playing my accordion.
Oh.
And anyway, brings back great memories, and just thought I would mention that. Too bad I couldn't get on TV now with my accordion.
Boy, you know, we've lost something. We don't have these local shows anymore to have local talent. We should have a local version of American Idol. I mean, that was...
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, at least it's special. Well, yeah. Why don't you do it, Mike?
All right, we'll put that on. I'll talk to Steve this afternoon.
About having a local show. That would be a really good idea.
Just
look at the number of people who show up for American Idol.
Yeah, no, it's a good idea.
All right, Irene, maybe you can still get on television.
There you go.
Never know. Well, this has been delightful. Thank you so much. Tell people again, it starts tonight, and it's Tuesdays.
Yeah, it starts tonight, 7 o'clock, and it's every 7 o'clock every Tuesday for the next 4 weeks are the new episodes, and then after that, they're going to rerun some of last season. So it's a whole season, 8 or 9 right. episodes of Pioneers of Television.
All right, very nicely done. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mike Trinkline, our guest this hour, producer of Pioneers of Television. He's a Wisconsin guy. As he said, a lot of this was done in this area in Milwaukee, and he has done a great deal of work for PBS and taught for a number of years in Idaho, and is also the author of a book on the American States, which was a bestseller. All right. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show and Chrissy Pease for on-air production.